It's hard to believe that we're already at our last conference, and it's not our last meeting together, but you'll see from the schedule, and those of you who have made the retreat before know that we do the Sunday part a little bit differently, and by the Sunday part I teach you the monastic practice that Sunday, following the old Jewish tradition, begins at sundown the day before. And so tonight at Vespers is the beginning of the monks' Sunday celebration. It's called First Vespers, the first Vespers of Sunday. And tomorrow's Vespers is Second Vespers of Sunday. So I want you to tune into that fact. It's just not Saturday Vespers, but it's the beginning of the weekly celebration of the Lord's resurrection that Sunday is for us Christians. It's for that same reason that on Sunday night in the monastery, we don't have compline, which is night prayer of the church, but instead we place the vigil prayer that we have every day. We place the vigil prayer on Saturday night. And we do that, it's a longer prayer than our normal vigil prayer, certainly longer than compline. And it is a prayer that echoes in its structure the Easter Vigil, which is also always celebrated by the church on Saturday night. So the Easter Vigil, which is celebrated on Saturday night of Easter, is echoed every week that way in the monastery by its vigil prayer. So check your schedules for that too, and be aware that if you come to prayer with us at Vespers, that you're beginning the Sunday celebration. You'll see for that reason also, if you look closely at the monks coming in procession, the monks who are in solemn vows will be wearing the garment that they are clothed with in solemn vows, which is called a kukula, or alternately called a choir robe. And it's a great big robe that drapes over these clothing, and it's full of pleats. And there are 73 pleats in it, one for each chapter of the Holy Rule. So you're just clothing yourself in the rule. It's also a big, ungainly garment that's good for doing nothing in except prayer. So that's also part of its point. It's a big, long garment. You can, in a sense, we're all in black. It's hard to tell the difference. But maybe I'll bring it over tomorrow if I remember and let you see it up close and show you how we put it on and all that. I don't think the roof's high enough, though, for me. No, quite literally, we turn them on inside out so that they don't get dusty as they hang all week. And then we flip them over our heads like that. It's a great scene in the monastery when you don't see it, but the monks are in the hallway going, phoom, phoom. This is another thing that impresses the novices, you know. They see that for the first time. Anyway, to be aware of that, somebody asked about vigils. Why is there vigils on Saturday night? That's the answer to that. That's the vigil of Sunday. And also note in your schedule that we sleep an hour later on Sunday and begin the first prayer of the morning is at Lauds. Close readers of the rule will note that Benedict says monks should get up earlier on Sunday. In fact, we don't. But we go to bed later praying vigils through the night. So, all right. There was another mild little announcement I wanted to make. I don't remember what it is, so let's hope it comes to me. Let's go back to where we left off and do what we can do with the time that remains for us. As I said, this is the last conference that I'll give. Yes, this is the other thing I wanted to say. And according to our long-standing custom, we devote Saturday night to some music and art. And often we've done what we're going to do tonight. Julie Hoy is with us, whose beautiful music so many of us appreciate. And I contacted her before the retreat began and asked her to listen carefully, and to choose some music for us to begin with, to help us. I task to her, the abbot asked her to help us to meditate with her music and to help us to pray. And I knew I could ask her that because she's done that before. She's helped us to meditate and she's helped us to pray. And I, for my part, will read to you from some selections from my book, A Monk's Alphabet. A lot of you know that book, but I made selections from there that have particularly to do with life in the monastery. If you know the book, a lot of the book talks about things other than the monastery. But we'll concentrate tonight on passages that directly relate something from the monastic life, and I think that will be more of the retreat in a different genre. So we have that to look forward to tonight, and then tomorrow morning, as is our custom, we will have sharing of the impact of the retreat and questions, if you wish. I don't like to just call it questions. I like to call it sharing, because there's been so many graces every year, and it's important that we share those graces with one another. So I mentioned that in advance to ask you to think about how you could share with the community some of the things that struck you and that were graces for you during the retreat. Michael just can't sit down. What is it? yeah, that's fine. What
this
do you?
This is for prosperity, so I need to make sure I turned on the device to make sure it's recording. Sorry, it's on.
Okay. Okay. All right, so let's go back to where we were. We were on chapter 58, halfway through that chapter, on the procedure for receiving brothers. We'll be on page 79, at verse 17. So far we read the qualities that we're looking for in the new monk. And beginning at verse 17, in a relatively brief way, the ceremony or the liturgical ritual for this is sketched out. And I use the term sketched quite consciously. It's not a full-blown detail of how to do the liturgy, but in monasteries over the centuries, a very carefully formulated ritual of how to do this has been built up. And it differs from monastic groups to monastic groups. The Swiss monks have a tradition of how to do it. The Swiss American monks have a tradition of how to do it. But it's all rooted in ways of patterning in our present culture, the values that we'll see here. By reading this in the rule, we're not going to so much study the liturgy as learn by Benedict's indications what the liturgical rite of pronouncing these promises is expressing and means. The most immediate equivalent that from our own experience that we would know is that when you get married, it means a lot of things. And a wedding ceremony expresses that. So we've looked at the things that need to be in place for this to be a successful marriage. Now the ceremony, okay? Verse 17. When he is to be received, he comes before the whole community in the oratory and promises stability, fidelity to monastic life, and obedience. Those are three promises. We also call them vows. Stability, fidelity to monastic life, and obedience. Catholics and perhaps others have often heard of religious life described with the vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. And generally, in the Catholic world, other religious orders profess those vows: poverty, chastity, and obedience. So other religious orders, poverty means holding property in common and living a simple life. Chastity means a celibate life and a chaste life as a celibate. And obedience is as we've seen it here. Whereas the monastic vows are stability, which is unique to the monastic life. And by stability, we bind ourselves by that vow to be a member of one particular monastic community for life. So unlike virtually all the other orders in the church, monks are not transferable from one assignment to another in different places. Monks are sometimes assigned by their abbot to go somewhere else and work, but never permanently. They always remain a member of a particular community. And the norm is to stay in the monastery, at the particular monastery, where you make the vow of stability. This creates something that other religious orders don't experience. It creates a stable community. We don't have a community with mature members coming from elsewhere when they're 15, 60 years old and adjusting here. We have a community that grows from youth to old age in the same place. And this makes quite a difference on the monk's experience. It also makes quite a difference for what the community is able to do. People, when they live in a place for a long time, really kick into dedication to that place and to committing to it. Fidelity to monastic life is a kind of an interpretive translation of the Latin expression conversatio morum. Conversatio morum more literally would mean changing my mores, changing the way I live. Conversatio morum. It's an interpretation to call it fidelity to monastic life. But that's a good interpretation in the sense that the vow is to live by everything in this world, which is completely changing my way of life. Fidelity to the monastic life in all its details. We've seen Saint Benedict urging that this rule be followed and urging that the abbot be followed. The fidelity to the monastic life is a fidelity to the rule, to the customs of the house, to the whole monastic tradition as it has been handed down to us. And the next vow, obedience, is the vow to the obedience to the abbot, and we will see in another chapter that we're going to read this afternoon, other types of obedience to other members in the community. And you could, in a certain sense, the vows of poverty and chastity, well, not in a certain sense, but in a technical sense, the vows of poverty and chastity are inside the vow of conversatio morum. That's the monastic life is not possible without holding property in common and without living a chaste and celibate life. So that's constitutive in that sense. You could ask, well, wouldn't obedience be inside that too? And it isn't in the same way, or it's identified by Saint Benedict as a separate vow, because remember the definition of a Cenobite. A Cenobite is somebody who lives under a rule and an abbot. So the vow of conversatio morum, or the vow of fidelity to the monastic life, is a vow to live by the rule and its traditions, whereas the vow of obedience is a vow to the living and interpretive voice of the abbot. The abbot is a living, actual interpreter of the rule here and now for these monks who have stability in this community. So those are the vows. The vow is that Benedict first envisions here. He comes before the whole community and promises this. He's envisioning an oral promise. And we know that because the most ancient rituals show us in that way. The abbot asks what the monk wants. He answers, I wish to share the sufferings of Christ in this monastery till death. And then the abbot asks him, do you therefore vow these vows? To which he answers, yes. So those are vows made in an oral promise. Where? In the church, in the presence of the whole community. And what does that mean? Verse 18. This is done in the presence of God and his saints, whom we believe are present to us in the church. That's the point of doing it there, as opposed into a beautiful park. You have the ceremony. You can do other things in a beautiful park, but this happens in the oratory, because there's a special presence of God there, and the center of the community's life happens in the oratory. Okay? God and his saints to impress on the novice that if he ever acts otherwise, he will surely be condemned by the one he mocks. This obviously is one of the toughest lines of the whole Holy Rule. And, you don't want to get, you can get all off on theology here. You know, is God going to smash monks that fail in their vows? God doesn't smash anybody. Don't worry about that. But Saint Benedict is keenly aware, and he wants the monk to be keenly aware, that this promise is viewed by the community, by the church, and by God and his saints. And it's deadly serious. And to act otherwise is a kind of mockery of God. And so why would anyone risk that? Love. Those who are married risk that same kind of vow. Why do you vow that? You vow that. Why do you vow marriage? Why do you vow monastic life? You vow that because you know, after long deliberation, as Benedict calls it, you know what your best choice for love is. And you know that you're weak and will not be able to hold yourself to it without the vow. And that is very true of monastic life. As the years and decades go on, there are sensible reasons to leave. And without the vow, we would have all been gone by now. And probably many of you can say that about your marriages as well. Okay? But that's not... That's about love. Think of how deep the love is that you express when you marry your spouse. What are you saying? The rest of my life with you. And the monk is saying something similar. It's the biggest act of love that a person can make. And it's the biggest risk that a person can take. And we don't want people taking this risk without knowing what they're doing. And then it really becomes a huge and best act of love. The novice writes out this document himself. I said it was an oral promise in verse 17, but it's also a written promise. And here is an interesting cultural thing that Saint Benedict borrows from Roman law, the context in which he was living in the Roman Empire, the late Roman Empire, is that there were two ways of making a solemn promise, and involved saying it, that your word counted, and writing it and signing it. And Benedict does both. Okay, so the novice writes out this document himself, or if he is illiterate, used to be more of them then, if he is illiterate, then he asks for someone else to write it for him, but he himself puts his mark on it and with his own hand lays it on the altar. Okay, so this is, we still do this today. The abbot does an oral questioning, and after the oral questioning, the monk has written out in advance the document and comes before the whole community and reads out the vows in a very solemn and ancient formula in which he makes the promises, finishing by saying, "This I have written in my own hand and signed it here, on the 12th day of September 2016 in the presence of Abbot Jeremy Driscoll, who was ever the abbot, abbot of this monastery and its monks, very solemnly. And then he holds up the document so everyone can see it. And then he and the abbot walk over to the altar and lay that document on the altar. And think about this, the altar where the sacrifice of the Mass is offered, where we believe the body and blood of Christ are present, making the sign of Christ's sacrifice. In that place, the monk signs his vows, and the abbot signs his vows. And after that, the gifts are put on the altar, and the Eucharist is celebrated over his vows. So you have to mean it. You have to mean it. I tell the novices, or I tell the juniors when they're doing this and when I'm going through this part of the rule with them so they know exactly what the ceremony means, I said, if you made the oral promises and then there were an earthquake in church and we all ran out, we did that once, we had an earthquake during Lod's, so we all left. But anyhow, if you had an earthquake before you read the written promises and signed, you would be professed. The oral promise is good, but Benedict is just sealing it. And he also wants a record. He wants a paper trail. So watch what you do with the paper trail. Verse 21. After he has put it there, the novice begins the verse, "Receive me, O Lord, as you have promised, and I shall live. Do not disappoint me in my hope." This is a beautiful and very moving moment of the ceremony. The ceremony is moving from top to bottom. But the tradition has developed the detail that the monk walks to the end of the choir and stretches out his hands and receives and sings this psalm verse three times. It's translated here, "Receive me, O Lord." We sing it according to the words, "Accept me, O Lord." But I think "accept" is perhaps a better translation of "sushipe." But what it means is, I've just offered myself to God, and I beg him to receive my offering. I should have thought to practice to sing it, but let's see if I can do it. "Accept me, O Lord, as you have promised. Accept me, and I shall live. Do not disappoint me in my hope." And then all of the other monks rise and sing it after him. And then he walks three steps forward, and the pitch is raised. "Accept me, O Lord, as you have promised." And then repeated. And then, "Accept me, O Lord, as you have promised." It's a shout. And let's read on then. The whole community repeats the verse three times, still done like that at Mount Angel, 1,500 years later. Beautiful. And then adds at the end, "Glory be to the Father." To say that this offering of this monk, or of these monks together, often there's more than one, the offering of these monks together is to give glory to the Trinity. Then the novice prostrates himself at the feet of each monk to ask his prayers. And from that very day, he is counted as one of the community. That's a short little sentence that the ritual through the centuries has developed into quite a dramatic time of prayer. The prostration at the feet of each monk to ask for prayers, in fact, takes place first by the monk lying on the floor right where the altar is. So his promise is on the altar. He lies on the floor after he's sung this text three times. He lies on the floor, and then the monks begin, it's like a drumbeat chant of psalm verses, praying for him at great length as he just lies there still. And okay, so let's read on. If he has any possessions, he should either give them to the poor beforehand or make a formal donation of them to the monastery without keeping back a single thing for himself. Well aware, so you have no personal money left after this time, huh? You can give it to the poor or you can give it to the monastery, but you can't keep a bank account of your own. And some people have to despoil themselves of a lot. So much the better for the poor or for the monastery, depending on what they do. You know? But well aware, from that day on, he will not even have his own body at his disposal. It's fairly strong too, isn't it? Not even have his own body at his disposal. Then and there in the oratory, he is to be stripped of everything of his own that he is wearing and clothed in what belongs to the monastery. We, in fact, have developed the clothing of the monk earlier than that, but we have a further clothing in these garments that I said to watch for at Vespers tonight. Another garment goes on over this. But the exchange of clothing is also a deep kind of sign working. And look how it works in verse 27. The clothing taken from him is to be put away and kept safely in the wardrobe, so that should he ever agree to the devil's suggestion and leave the monastery, which God forbid, he can be stripped of the clothing of the monastery before he is cast out. So the clothing, even the clothing of your body, belongs to the monastery and shows that you belong to the monastery. And but we keep your old clothes behind so that we can say, okay, we'll have them back then. That would be an awful kind of moment. It should be an awful kind of moment for the monk to put on his old clothes again. I mean, you could have given them to the poor. And how many of them you think are going to leave? I don't know. But anyway, Benedict is extremely sensitive to the meaning of the clothing. And as monks, we try to be sensitive to that and why we wear these clothes. But the document of his, which the abbot took from the altar, should not be given back to him, but kept in the monastery. That's the paper trail. And it witnesses to the offering that was made. Okay, we got to push on. There's a lot there, huh? A great, strong chapter that tells us a lot about monastic life. But let's push on and to a few more jewels. Turn the pages and see what we're skipping. The offering of sons by nobles to the poor, the admission of priests to the monastery, the reception of visiting monks. You hope they're not Gyrovegs or Sarabaites, you know. Got to watch out for that. Priests of the monastery. Community rank is a beautiful chapter. It's how the monks are to relate to each other. But let's just jump down to verse 10 in chapter 63, where we read about the younger monks and their relationship to the seniors. The younger monks, then, must respect their seniors, and the seniors must love their juniors. Very important line, huh? Just cultivating an atmosphere in the house. Again, in Benedict's cultural situation, this is radical advice. Okay? Elders didn't treat juniors with love. It just, they did other stuff. Oh, you dumb little kid, you know? It isn't that way in the monastery. Respecting the seniors and the seniors loving the juniors. When they address one another, no one should be allowed to do so simply by name. Rather, the seniors call the younger monks brother, and the younger monks call their seniors nonus, which is translated as venerable father. That's a Latin word, nonus. It developed into the Italian title for grandfather, nonno, which is a very nice, affectionate name for your grandfather in the Italian language, which comes directly from the Latin. We don't use that, but we use the title father. But so we don't call each other by our first names generally in the monastery, although that's not a hard and fast rule. But again, to catch the point of Benedict, for the most part, we do call each other brother and father. And the reason we do that is to constantly remind ourselves that this just we're not just two guys bumping into each other. We are bound to each other in a particular relationship by the vows we have made. And the vows put us in a relationship that we wouldn't otherwise have. You're not necessarily or naturally friends with all the other monks in the monastery. You didn't choose the people you're living with in the monastery. That's part of the mystery of God, is who's there. And so for that reason also, to use the title father and brother is very helpful in establishing a balance and an order in the community. That's the meaning for that. But the abbot, because he is believed that he holds the place of Christ, repeating what we saw in chapter 2, is to be called Lord and Abbot, not for any claim of his own, but out of honor and love for Christ. Lord sounds funny to us in English. It's Dominus in Latin, and that has not come over into English usage, and because it just sounds weird somehow to us. And even to follow the rule, you don't want to just do weird things. But for many centuries, this title was used, and is still used in an abbreviated form, even in English. In some monastic traditions where they would call their abbot, short for Dominus is Dom. In fact, English abbots tend to refer to me, I noticed this in the meeting at Rome, is good morning, Dom Jeremy. So, sounds kind of classy, but we don't do it. The point, again, I just want you to see that the abbot has a title, and that the title abbot is also important. And why does the abbot have a title? Out of respect for Christ, because of what is believed about the abbot. And so just the naming and the way we use names is very important. The abbot, for his part, must reflect on this, and in his behavior show himself worthy of such an honor. Who knows if I've shown myself worthy or can show myself worthy of that, but you did and have heard me reflecting on it all during this retreat and sharing with you how struck I have been by the fact of the way the monks relate to me. The monks with whom I've lived for 43 years relate to me through what they believe the abbot to be. I'm reflecting on that. Where this next part, I think, is so lovely. When brothers meet, the junior asks his senior for a blessing. And when an older monk comes by, the younger rises and offers him a seat and does not presume to sit down unless the older bids him. Again, we don't practice that literally or quite so bluntly, let's say, but for sure it's practiced, and what St. Benedict is concerned about here is down to the detail of the way we would pass one another. This is not a planned meeting. But when we pass one another, there's such thing as body language that is asking for a blessing and showing respect. And I told you that in the monastery, we keep silence all day long. But we never pass each other without acknowledging in silence each other's presence. And what in fact that means is asking for a blessing. And the younger monks rising and waiting for the senior to bid him to sit down. I've noticed that we have a period in our schedule in the evening after dinner whereas a community, we break the silence and sit together and talk, and on a nice evening you can go for a walk. And so the people are coming and going. And some of the smart aleck young monks, when I walk into the room, all stand up, you know, and I never did that before. And I said, okay, stay standing. But it's sweet. They've read this part of the rule, and they're having fun, and it's good. They know what's going on. All of that is summarized very nicely in this way. They do what the words of Scripture say. They should each try to be the first to show respect to the other, as Paul urged in the letter to the Romans. That's a community at peace, if that can happen. Huh? Benedict repeats that later in chapter 72 at verse 4. In the oratory and at table, small boys and youths are kept in rank and under discipline. Outside or anywhere else, they should be supervised and controlled until they are old enough to be responsible. Chapter 64 is another long chapter on the abbot, the election of an abbot. I referred that to you when we looked at chapter 62. And we don't have a lot of time to go over this, but there's a few things that I think are also very telling and helpful about understanding what St. Benedict expects of the abbot. And also here, too, in this chapter, you can learn ways that you can pray for me so that I can become the kind of abbot that St. Benedict is hoping for. Let's skip down to verse 7. Which we're skipping over the possibility of a bad abbot being elected. That's verses 3 to 6. So let's presume that hasn't happened. And start at verse 7, all right? Once in office, the abbot must keep constantly in mind the nature of the burden he has received and remember to whom he will have to give an account of his stewardship. Let him recognize that his goal must be profit for the monks and not preeminence for himself. You can see what an important injunction this is, precisely because of what the abbot is believed to be, and precisely because of the signs of respect that are shown to the abbot, and also for the fact that the abbot has the freedom to make decisions about everything, including his own behavior and where he goes. And so it could be, and has been in the history of monasticism, a great temptation for abbots to lord it over and simply have a good time. And that's not what it's about at all. It's not about preeminence. It's about profiting the monks. The abbot is abbot for the monks. He ought, therefore, to be learned in the divine law so that he has a treasury of knowledge from which he can bring out what is new and what is old. This, too, is an off-sided verse of the rule as the sign of that abbots need the kind of wisdom that will let them do the new thing and will also let them do the old thing, and know which is required for now. And at its best, Benedictine life has been a magnificent kind of balance between new and old. You rarely find in a monastery radical new versions of things. And you just don't find either just old stuff. When an abbot becomes abbot, it's been the custom that he choose a motto that expresses the kind of abbot that he hopes to be. And you can't express everything in a motto. But the great abbot of Mount Angel, Abbot Bonaventure, chose as his motto, new things and old. And it was a wonderful description of what was so strong about him as a man. He was a man saturated in the tradition, and completely free to do the new thing. And he really marked my own life. And I hope I might have learned some of that from him. The abbot must be chaste, temperate, and merciful. He should always let mercy triumph over judgment. Again, the biblical warrant for that. So that he too may win mercy. He must hate faults, but love the brothers. And when he must punish them, he should use prudence and avoid extremes. Otherwise, by rubbing too hard to remove the rust, he may break the vessel. What a vivid image that is, huh? What a very vivid, strong metaphor. And monks are always reminding their abbot of this one. Don't break me! He is to distrust his own frailty and remember not to crush the bruised reed. These are the sentence after sentence of balance. Huh? It's like saying, hey, come on, you got to really be abbot. You got to really do it. And then really be careful doing it. These are people you're dealing with. He's being very careful here. By this, we do not mean that he should allow faults to flourish, but rather, as we have already said, he should prune them away with prudence and love as he sees best for each individual. Let him strive to be loved rather than feared. That's the summary sentence of everything he's trying to balance here. Let him strive to be loved rather than feared. Here's good personal advice for an abbot that's worried. Excitable, anxious, extreme, obstinate, jealous, or over-suspicious, he must not be. Everything that leaders can be inclined to be. Why? Because there's so much responsibility on them. So those are not things easy to escape from when you have a lot of responsibility. And yet Benedict is saying, you got to do something about that. It can't be that way. Such a man is never at rest. Instead, he must show forethought and consideration in his orders. And whether the task he assigns concerns God or the world, he should be discerning and moderate, bearing in mind the discretion of Holy Jacob, who said, if I drive my flocks too hard, they will all die in a single day. Every time Benedict justifies what he's teaching by those scriptural citations, I love it. Because the net effect of that piling up in one teaching after another, the net effect is to teach us as monks that, in effect, what we're living here in the monastery is the Bible story. This is the Bible story effectively lived in this school of the Lord's service. Therefore, drawing on this and other examples of discretion, the mother of virtues, the abbot must so arrange everything that the strong have something to yearn for, and the weak nothing to run from. That too is a formulation that I really appreciate. And in a big community like this, an abbot's got a lot to look at. And I've got strong monks who need to be challenged and give their lives. And I've got weak monks that I mustn't frighten. And we need to go together in this. This is true of our lives everywhere. Verse 20, he must above all keep this rule in every particular. So that's the abbot is the interpreter of the rule. So that when he has ministered well, he will hear from the Lord what that good servant heard who gave his fellow servants grain at the proper time. I tell you solemnly, he said, he sets him over all his possessions. Chapter 65 is on the prior of the monastery, the idea of appointing a number two man, which the abbot is able to do and which we practice here. Chapter 66 is the porter of the monastery. Let's just read it. It'll bring, I think, a little smile to your lips. And again, it's a smile in which you're admiring how much Benedict understands human nature, but also how he wants people to be met. At the door of the monastery, place a sensible old man who knows how to take a message and deliver a reply. Okay, so not a busybody. Okay. Knows how to take a message and deliver a reply. And whose age keeps him from roaming about. The porter will need a room near the entrance so that the visitors will always find him there to answer them. And this next part I like very much. As soon as anyone knocks or a poor man calls out, he replies, "Thanks be to God," or "Your blessing, please." To me, that's an attitude that needs to move through every knock on every door and every time the phone rings. Practice that if you can. Thanks be to God. I think of how often there's a knock on my door and I moan. But Benedict doesn't want that. Huh? Here we, again, we see the sweet atmosphere that Benedict wants in the monastery. Imagine, they say, "I don't know who it is. Thanks be to God." Why? Because of what we believe about a guest. In them, Christ is coming. Thanks be to God. And asking the guest for his blessing. Then, with all the gentleness that comes from the fear of God, he provides a prompt answer with the warmth of love. Look at that. Gentleness, fear of God, a prompt answer, and the warmth of love. There's something really wonderful when that can happen. And I've been to monasteries where there's someone at the door like that. And it's just the most amazing thing, you know. Have we met, you know? It's like they're welcoming back as an old friend. And let the porter be given one of the younger brothers if he needs help. Let's skip because these last chapters are all quite good and interesting. But I want to get to the end so that we read that carefully together. Brothers sent on a journey. Chapter 68 we read last night in conjunction with the fourth step of humility in chapter 7, the assignment of impossible tasks to a brother. We saw again how careful Benedict is there, but also how much he requires of the monk. Chapter 69, the presumption of defending another in the monastery. That's a very short chapter, but It's quite important when you think about it. What can happen in the monastery is that the superior is correcting one monk and another comes to his defense. That doesn't make it very easy for the abbot or whoever is doing the correction, and it certainly doesn't make a clear story line for the person that's being corrected. So that's not supposed to be happening. And no slugging or kicking, that's chapter 70, okay? And I think that was a culture and the types of people that came to the monastery in those cultures. Apparently they hit each other more often than we tend to do now. Although, you know, we do it with our tongues, of course. That's our way, and perhaps that's worse. Who knows? There are great stories in the Mount Angel lore of the previous generations of monks who lived here. I mean, these were characters that our predecessors, the way they fought with each other was extremely creative. I could tell you lots of stories, but I mean, things like that, it shouldn't happen, but I'm sort of glad they did because we got great stories. But there was one monk who just didn't like the prior at all. And he did everything he could to bug him. And the prior was incapable of running any machines. And so this monk would go, it would park a lawnmower under his window and leave it running. And the prior would come out and start kicking it, you know. But in a certain sense, it was good for both of them. I don't know why I say that. It's funny to know that monks can descend to this and still make it in the end, you know. Anyway, let's come to chapter 71, which is really a beautiful chapter, mutual obedience. And I've just alluded to this. So far we've used the word obedience, talking about obedience to the abbot or to the prior or to superiors. But here is another take on what obedience is. And certainly this is a chapter that I think can be easily applied in your own life circumstances as well, whether in your homes or at work. Obedience is a blessing to be shown by all, not only to the abbot, but also to one another as brothers, since we know that it is by this way of obedience that we go to God. How often in the rule, and we've just been skipping around in the rule, how often in the rule have we seen obedience as a way to God? Therefore, although orders of the abbot or of the priors appointed by him take precedence, and no unofficial order may supersede them, in every other instance, younger monks should obey their seniors with all love and concern. Again, love is associated with obedience. That's what obedience is about. And concern here, in Latin, solicitudine, with solicitude. Like, what is it, Father? That's obedience. Hey, could you help me? What is it, Father? That's obedience. Right? Something's needed. What is it? That's lively, quick, prompt obedience. Anyone found objecting to this should be reproved. If a monk is reproved in any way by his abbot or by one of his seniors, even for some small matter, or if he gets the impression that one of his seniors is angry or disturbed with him, however slightly, he must then and there and without delay cast himself on the ground at the other's feet to make satisfaction and lie there until the disturbance is calmed by a blessing. In our culture, this is not literally practiced, but you see my method now, and it's the method that monks have used through the centuries when a literal practice is no longer employed. We most certainly do not want to lose the value. What's the value here? The value here is, as soon as I realize that another brother is unhappy with me, I am willing to humble myself. And Benedict wants a dramatic gesture, and he's saying, use your body for it. And you can do that. I mean, that's a bit dramatic, at least in our culture. But think it through, just in terms of what it means, down on the ground in front of you saying, I'm sorry. It works. It works. Our bodies are for that. What we do with our bodies says, I'm sorry. Benedict wants a house full of peace. And Christian houses should be houses full of peace. And they won't be full of peace unless we, in quotation marks, unless we get down on the ground in front of each other and say, I'm sorry. And unless the other gives a blessing. I know you're sorry. I bless you. Okay? Find ways to do that. That's mutual obedience. Anyone who refuses to do this should be subjected to corporal punishment. Or if he is stubborn, should be expelled from the monastery. Look at that. Benedict simply does not want this community busted up by aggressive behaviors. And we're all prone to them. And unless they're stopped, the community can be absolutely poisoned. And so monasteries are always at risk for this. People lose track of themselves and their good promises. And unless they're recalled to the promise they made, this won't happen. Now, chapter 72, a beautiful finish to the rule. Commentators will say the rule finishes twice. It finishes with chapter 72, and you're just going, oh my God, that's so beautiful, that's a great finish. And then he goes, ah, shucks, it was nothing. That's chapter 73, okay? So let's read the big strong finish, and then we'll watch him go, ah, shucks, it was nothing, okay? Chapter 72. Just as there is a wicked zeal of bitterness which separates from God and leads to hell, so there is a good zeal which separates from evil and leads to God and everlasting life. This then is the good zeal which monks must foster with fervent love. We're always citing this chapter to each other. We use the expression in the monastery a lot, and we know we're alluding to the rule. We talk about, you got good zeal, or whump up some good zeal, and we're meaning what's in this chapter. Or we sometimes accuse one another, you know, you got some bad zeal going here. It really has happened. There's attitudes that will separate you from God, and that are harming the community. So we need to foster in this monastery good zeal. We need to foster in this nation good zeal. We need to foster in the church good zeal. Okay? So what would the good zeal be? They should each try to be the first to show respect to the other. We just saw that already. It's the same citation, Romans 12:10. We saw it at chapter 63, verse 15. He obviously important to him. Sometimes translated, and I like that translation, vying with each other to be the first to show respect. There's a contest here. I will beat you to showing you respect. Okay? What a lovely attitude, okay? Supporting with the greatest patience one another's weaknesses of body or behavior. Okay? Some people are just sick and weak in their bodies. Other people just can't help the way they behave, and you need to be patient. They're not because they're bad, they just keep losing their temper or something. And earnestly compete in obedience to one another. What we just said in the previous chapter, competing in obedience to one another. No one is to pursue what he judges better for himself, but instead what he judges better for someone else. Why would anyone want to act this way? Christ, love of Christ, imitation of Christ, the servant. I want to be like Christ. And I'm with fellow believers here. I'm with fellow monks. I'm with other monks that are seeking God. I'm with other monks who are eager for the work of God. And I want this place, I just want love to flow. That's good zeal. So the way you do that is very concretely. What would be good for him? I'm not thinking about myself. What would be good for him? That's good zeal. Verse 8. To their fellow monks, they show the pure love of brothers. To God, loving fear. To their abbot, unfeigned and humble love. Let them prefer nothing whatever to Christ. And may he bring us all together to everlasting life. That's the finish of the rule, huh? Very important. In the rule itself, you can feel it as the sentence is read, but also in the centuries, the commentators have always commented on the fact of the significance in Benedict's rule, and everything we've read that precedes this is really an underlining of the all together. Everybody goes together, or no one goes. And so the strong don't ever get out so far ahead that the weak aren't brought along. And the weak are not allowed to keep the whole thing from moving. So where we're going is all together to everlasting life. In the same way that Abbot Bonaventure marked the community with his motto, new things in old, Abbot Peter, who followed him as abbot, chose as his motto, all together unto everlasting life. And it was a beautiful dimension of the atmosphere of his whole abbacy, that he was a man, he's still alive, but as abbot he was a man always careful of other people and always careful to bring the whole community along. So here's another verse that in the history of our particular abbey has marked the history of this particular abbey. That's a good place to end the rule, but here's a little coda that Benedict puts onto it that places this rule in the context of the rest of the tradition, which I spoke about at the start. Benedict is not monasticism dropped from the sky. Benedict is monasticism several hundred years into its own development with the tradition behind it. Benedict is a decision and new choices within that monastic tradition. He certainly embodies in the holy rule that he wrote, he certainly embodies new things and old. But here's where how he places this rule in the context of the whole monastic tradition. He says, the reason we have written this rule is that by observing it in monasteries, we can show that we have some degree of virtue and the beginnings of monastic life. So he's not hoping for too much vis-a-vis the tradition. Some virtue and the beginnings of monastic life. But for anyone hastening on to the perfection of monastic life, there are the teachings of the Holy Fathers, the observance of which will lead him to the very heights of perfection. All that is his way of referring to a tradition that precedes him. And then also, in a certain sense, it's an inspired kind of remark that he's making here. Because in a sense, I don't know that he intends it. I don't think he does. But in a sense, he defended his rule from the criticism of it's not strict enough. Because you would be able to say to Benedict at the time he wrote, look, there's all this tradition, and monasticism is a lot tougher than you make it. And he's just saying, well, I'm not really writing for the tough. And if tough is what you want, read the Holy Fathers. That's the position he's taking. What page, what passage of the inspired books of the Old and New Testaments is not the truest of guides for human life? What books of the Holy Catholic Fathers does not resoundingly summon us along the way to reach the Creator? Then, besides the conferences of the Fathers, their institutes, and their lives, there is also the rule of our Holy Father Basil. So in those several sentences, Benedict has mentioned, in effect, three categories of reading. The scriptures, the fathers in general, and with these phrases, the conferences, institutes, and their lives, those are titles for monastic literature. So he just, and the effect of this has been to have monks always reading this literature. And it's remotely responsible for my having been sent away to get my doctorate in, I would be in verse 5, the lives of the monastic fathers. And so I specialized in monasticism that preceded Benedict by my lengthy studies of Evagrius. Because Benedict says the monks should read that stuff. This rule doesn't have the whole thing. Okay? And monks have always done that. Monks have been good scholars of scripture, good scholars of patristics, and good scholars of the monastic writings. For observant and obedient monks, all these are nothing less than tools for the cultivation of virtues. But for us, they make us blush for shame at being so slothful, so unobservant, so negligent. Are you hastening toward your heavenly home? Then, with Christ's help, keep this little rule that we have written for beginners. After that, you can set out for the loftier summits of the teaching and virtues we mentioned above. And under God's protection, you will reach them. Amen. So, Benedict is beginning at the beginning. And that's us, huh? We're beginners. And we may be beginners all our lives. Don't worry about it. This is enough for people like us. If you want the big stuff, go ahead. Go ahead. <to it. laughs> All right? But let's start here. Let's do this. Okay, that's it. It's a romp through the Holy Rule. So keep on sharing your reactions among yourselves, and do think about Sunday morning sharing and some ways you might like to share with the whole group what the retreat has meant for you. Thanks for your good attention. Vespers at 5:15.